This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to Slot and to the Health Ecologies Lab on such a rainy day. We really appreciate your presence. My name is Aaron Levy. I'm the executive director of Slot, and I'm a senior lecturer in English and History of Art at Penn.
My name is Lynn Herr. I'm a recent graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, where I studied biology and nutrition, and I was a student of Professor Levy this past semester.
The structure for today's program will be a facilitated conversation of about 45 minutes or so. Following that, we'll have time for some informal conversation as well. For those of you that are new to Slot, we're a nonprofit organization here on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania. We've been here for about 17 years. And for those 17 years, our programming has crossed the arts and humanities, public culture, social equity, social justice, and more. We work with communities and with institutions, and we ardently believe in the power of dialogue to drive change and the role that the arts can play in helping us discover ourselves and imagine ourselves in others. We hope that you'll come back for future programs with artists, scholars, policymakers, activists, and more. You can learn more on our website, slot.org. You can sign up for a mailing list. You can also, kind of through all of that work, be introduced to some of the partners we've worked with. Today, this program is presented with the Department of English at Penn. Before turning it back over to Lynn, this program is also presented with the Health Ecologies Lab, which is comprised of a group of students, faculty, and community members at Penn and across Philly, all concerned about the impact that social structures and systems have on individual and community well-being. We develop all kinds of projects, research, curricula. We have a reading group that meets regularly, and we hope that, again, that you'll participate in that work and come back. You can learn more on the website at healthecologieslab.org. And then finally, the conversation that we're having today is also going to be informing the work of the Penn Medicine Listening Lab, which is a forthcoming project and storytelling initiative created by a number of patients, caregivers, staff, and providers at Penn Medicine. Many of them are here today. And that project really seeks to foster a culture of listening and to affirm the power of listening in enhancing the well-being of our community. So we hope that you'll stay tuned for that project, which will open in October.
Yes, so this event has also emerged out of a class that was offered this past semester. It was given by the English department at Penn and was called The Literature of Care, and is where Professor Levy and I had first gotten to know one another. One of the very, very first readings that we read for this class was actually written by Dr. Sharon, so we are super thrilled that we get to mark the end of the course with her presence with us here today. Throughout the class, we built on the understanding that anyone who's experienced or has witnessed suffering or illness has a story to tell. These stories often involve complex feelings of loss, anxiety, fear, regret, but also hopes, dreams, and aspirations. And throughout the class, we read a wide variety of works by ethnographers, by historical and contemporary literary works by patients who are suffering from illnesses, and also editorials and peer-reviewed journals by physicians too. And all of these things that we read had raised and sought to answer the following questions. So how can the arts and the humanities help us to acknowledge the universality of the narratives that we see in illness? How can we develop a greater capacity to respond to human vulnerability and suffering in others? And how does injury and trauma affect the language, the memory? How does injury and trauma affect one's relationship to language, memory, and society today?
So as Lynn was just mentioning, throughout the course, we were like really attentive to how language can be a therapeutic vehicle for the patient, for the caregiver, and for the provider to communicate in the face of extraordinary pain, illness, death, and profound suffering. We were also attentive to how illness often renders us alienated from ourselves, but also the limits of language. In particular, scholars like Elaine Scarry in The Body and Pain have addressed the limits of communicating suffering. and the way that illness often disturbs and interrupts narrative form itself. So we're so excited that Dr. Sharon is here with us today because that course and all of this work seeks to bridge the arts and humanities and medicine. We think that her work has embodied this in the most extraordinary ways, both kind of the field of literature's commitment to thinking about the politics and practices of care, but also, of course, medicine's similar aspirations. And so we look forward to this conversation with you, but also how hopefully it can help all of us in this room address what we feel, I think many of us feel, is a crisis today surrounding empathy and compassion in medicine. So I'm going to turn over to Lynn, and we're going to get started.
And now to finally introduce you to our featured guest, Dr. Rita Sharon is a general internist and literary scholar at Columbia University who originated the field of narrative medicine. She is a professor of medicine and founder and executive director of the program in narrative medicine at Columbia. She completed an MD at Harvard in 1978 and a PhD in English at Columbia in 1999, concentrating on the works of Henry James. Her research focuses on the consequences of narrative medicine practice, reflective clinical practice, and healthcare team effectiveness. She's published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet, JAMA, Annals of Internal Medicine, and others. She is the author of Narrative Medicine, Honoring the Stories of Illness, and co-author of Principles and Practice of Narrative Medicine. She's co-editor of Stories Matter, The Role of Narrative in Medical Ethics, and Psychoanalysis and Narrative Medicine. And she is working on a book about creativity and doubt in the sciences and the arts.
So hello. I'm well aware that we are speaking about these topics in the presence of these images of violence. I hope you looked at the exhibit on the wall of both Palestinians and Israeli photographers recording and witnessing the terror and the traumas. So we're in the midst of lots of ways in which one's body becomes the target of either state-sponsored violence or biological aspects of one's physiology as physiology becomes pathophysiology. So that's kind of what we're talking about. Aaron and Lynn asked me to come to you with a story. Do you want me to tell the story?
Yeah, sure. I'll read out the prompts that we shared with
you. All right.
So everybody kind of has a sense of how we're coming to this. So we wanted to invite Dr. Sharon to begin with a story about listening in medicine, and we offered her a couple of prompts that are also going to be the prompts for that forthcoming Listening Lab project. And they were, can you share with us a story about yourself or someone you care about? And as you gather your thoughts, perhaps could you think of a time when you were a patient or were caring for someone who was a patient? What did it feel like to have someone listen to you or to really listen yourself?
So I thought about that. I mean, I've been in practice for 35 years in the medicine clinic at Presbyterian Hospital in New York, which is in Washington Heights, which is a immigrant Dominican neighborhood. My patients are poor and sick. They're sick because they're poor, in large part. I closed my practice a couple of years ago because I'm old and because I end up being away far more than I'm home, and it wasn't fair for patients to have a doctor who's away quite so much. I closed my practice. I miss it terribly. I especially miss the opportunities that medical practice gives one for committing acts of kindness. It's really what it is. You act kindly, and there are some technical things you do on the side. So when I read this question, I mean, there are many ghosts. It's 34 years of taking care of patients and watching them mostly get sick and eventually die, as we all do, but some get better, some stay better, some stay well. Anyway, here's the person that I thought of to give you. I used to run the writing division of our TV studio when I was an assistant professor of medicine. And one of my colleagues was the photographer, a still photographer. And she asked me at one point, could I be her doctor? I said, sure. So I became her doctor and her husband's doctor. And then I became her mother's doctor. And her mother was, at the point I started to take care of her, around 65 years old, and one of the very first thanatologists, one of the very first persons who study death. And she would do rubbings of gravestones, and she would, from the beginning, critique the ways in which medicine took care of her. So I became her doctor. She was relatively well. She drank far too much scotch. She smoked far too many cigarettes. And I became certain at the beginning that I was going to have no influence at all on that. So I did my best to kind of keep up with other things. She was a force of nature, very sharp. Sharp. She looked a little bit like Margaret Hamilton in The Wizard of Oz. Very short. Very smart. And then before anyone, tell me when I get close to the allotted time. Before anyone else noticed it, so I'm her internist, so I realize that she's losing her mind. There are signs that the internist follows. So I knew that she was becoming cognitively impaired, but it could be, you know, a long time from then. She was a writer. She was an editor and a writer, and she would show me her work. I remember she brought me a poem she wrote on the basis of Emma Lazarus's Statue of Liberty poem. So I did come to know her through her writing as well as through her body. The cognitive decline worsened. It became clear to not just me that she was losing her memory. I enlisted her in going to the neurologist to see how far the dementia had gone. She went. She comes back. She says, Dr. Carlson thinks I have dementia, but I don't. And there wasn't very much to be done. She took the pills that I gave her. She came in for regular appointments. But it was a very aggressive decline. And this force of nature, this sharp, really became... she would come into the office by the end, and she would just kind of stand. She couldn't sit. She'd just kind of stand. She'd put her hands in her pockets. And she couldn't follow, you know, a sentence. And I would stand, you know, across from her. We would both be standing there, hands in pockets. And the best I could come to was to answer her in her own words. And by the very end, she could phonate, but there weren't words. And she would, it was almost like doublespeak. Anyone doublespeak? She would go on with the patara, but it didn't make any sense. But I would like try my best to make it sound like what she was saying, and she would laugh. So that was how we kind of accompanied one another. And all the while, am I making sure that she got whatever the neurologist thought would help the dementia? There wasn't very much. So we got home attendants and people in the home, and her family made sure that she stayed home. My remember the photographer? So she was at the very end of her life, still at home, with 24-hour help. Last time I saw her alive was at Seder, at their house. I'm an old Catholic, but I know the story. And she was there. She was really kind of end stage in her dementia. And again, it was all bodily. She would walk very kind of shakily with her son-in-law walking backwards. Can you picture it? He would walk backwards like this, walking her, do you see? And then she died, and I got a phone call in the middle of a lecture that she had died at home, that the photographer, her daughter, realized what was happening. Her breathing was slowing. She decided not to call EMS, smart woman. And she texts in another hour or so to say that her mother had ceased breathing. And so I was the physician of record, so I called it in to the medical examiner with my name and my license number. And they did come and bring her body to the hospital, or actually bring the body directly to a funeral home of some kind where she was cremated. But it was only, so the next day, I'm in my office, I get paged by the security desk in the hospital that the funeral parlor man was there for me and that I had to come meet the funeral man, which I did, making sure to have a black pen in my pocket because I had to sign the death certificate. I've signed hundreds of them. But this one was, you can imagine, the power of my pronouncing her dead, this woman who had taught me so much about death and about life. And I was by then kind of family, not really family, kind of family. And I signed the death certificate. There's a whole drill of how you do these things. It has to be in black ink. And I do that, and I've got my white coat on, and I do that, and I give the paper back to the guy, and I'm, going to the stairwell to go back to what I was doing. And how does it happen cosmically that the person coming toward me as I'm about to go into the stairwell is Saigan, the palliative care Zen Buddhist chaplain? What cosmic force brought the Zen chaplain to my side? And as soon as I see him, my tears start and I embrace him and he embraces me and I tell him what has just happened. That's my story.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Do you see?
So, why is this sort of storytelling that you've just engaged with us so urgent and important to medicine? And also, what is it about language and literature that makes it such an extraordinary tool to be used in medicine that helps us to empathize with other people and maybe identify in others that we wouldn't
realize? I don't know if it's even fair to call language a tool, like screwdriver. I mean, it's kind of how we live. It's how we become ourselves. And you know what happens when you tell someone else. Your instructions were talk about a place in which you felt listened to. And the reason I chose that is that I felt listened to by the family, by the daughter, and by my chaplain. Do you see? But medicine is one of, infinite settings where we only know what we can express. It doesn't have to be in words. We only know what we can express. And the telling, verbal telling, or lexical, textual writing, or recording, allows us to confer some kind of form on something that has been lived through but not expressed. And if we live through something without expressing it, we lose it. We lose it. Whereas if we confer some form on it, if we represent it in some way, we're then able to perceive it. So that's the way in which I think of what is language doing in medicine. As kind of a footnote to a lot of what we say about stories in medicine, is that they don't have to be in language. I had to show you the physical gestures of parts of my story because I couldn't tell you how the son guided his mother-in-law, right? So it is words, it is gestures, it is silences, it is facial expressions, it is gestures of the body. It is a physical, like the liver edge. When you feel a liver edge in a patient's abdomen, that tells you something, right? So all of those are what I include in language. I don't know if I have the liberty to do that, but those are all ways of telling, ways of giving account. We say in narrative medicine that the central event of healthcare is when a person gives an account of self to a listener who is skilled to receive it.
Thank you. Also, in the years since that you founded the narrative medicine program at Columbia, the field has changed thanks to your efforts, but the way that medicine is practiced has also changed considerably. What felt like an intimate relationship of the sort that informed the poetry of people like William Carlos Williams is increasingly mediated by technology, insurance, politics, things of this nature.
Yeah.
Just to kind of piggyback on that, so we were hoping that you could share with us a little bit about how your own thoughts have shifted alongside all of these changes about the role of narrative medicine, and how can narrative medicine transform not only the relationship between the provider and the patient, but also the medical record, all of the digital architectures, the organizational structures that are producing so much.
You probably don't know what we're talking about, because we're using narrative medicine as if it were a word that everybody understands, but I'm sure you don't. So let me tell you what it is before we continue. And it was very much a marriage between medicine, like mainstream biological internal medicine, and literary studies, because I just had the great luxury of going back to graduate school after I had been in practice and taking a PhD. It was a great, great luxury. Because I was thirsting for guidance in how am I supposed to listen to these very complicated, contradictory, paradoxical parables, I didn't even know what to call them, these stories that I was hearing from patients and their families and other doctors and the EMS, and how was I just the, you know, what we called, we're now called PCPs, primary care providers. So what's the person in the GP supposed to do to cohere all of these different contradictory accounts? And they contradict. I mean, one is true and one is not true? I said, no, I can't decide what's true and not true. So I went to English and I said, you can help me learn about how stories work. And they said, sure. And they said, don't take a course, take a master's, like that. So but it was luxury, and it altered what I thought was medicine, because it suddenly became permissible for me to follow threads that were not necessarily biologically salient. And if a patient interrupts herself to say, oh, that was the year my daughter died, that I had the obligation to follow that, see, and so the script or the story of the illness really does not have to be restricted to the biotechnical. I mean, everybody says that, but indeed, if you're not equipped with the skills, the capacities to follow complex, very complex accounts, then you're lost. You don't know how to do it. Whereas if you have been trained to notice, when is there a pause? When is there, what I meant to say was, when does the face get averted? When do the fists clench? All of that. If you don't notice that the patient is using figural language, you know? I feel like, one guy said to me, I feel like a pipe, like everything I drink goes right through me. I'm saying, oh my God, he feels like a pipe. Do you see what I mean? So you have to be trained in language, in literary arts, to not squander what it is that patients and their families tell you. So that's what narrative medicine is. It's being a clinician with skills in complex language recognition, reception, interpretation. Not that you can nail what it is a patient means, but rather that you find yourself humbly in the face of something very complex, not totalizable, not reducible to anything, not paraphrasable, which holds a key of sorts to what might help the patient. So that's what we mean. And when we train people in narrative medicine, we train them how to read. I mean, I teach long semester courses in close reading, and we teach phenomenology. All our students read Merleau-Ponty and Levinas and Heidegger, and we have lots of visual arts, performative arts, so that it's a complex of receptions toward the ability of a clinician to simply do the job. So the ways in which it's changed is that it keeps getting bigger. And at the beginning, we were all literary people, so we paid attention to words. And now, over the past piece of time, we've expanded from, you know, fiction, poetry, nonfiction, drama, screenwriting, up to painting and photography and multimedia installations, and now we're doing music and dance as well. So it is all ways in which a human person can express what's inside. So that's one of the ways it's changed.
Isn't thinking about health disparities now, and those who don't have the security of a relationship with like a long-term provider, how can narrative medicine, like you just described, be used to transform the patient experience? Yeah.
So you know, do any of you work in hospitals? Like, not so many, but you know that they're like really dysfunctional now? You realize that what used to be even passable some 20 years ago, when we all wrote longhand and we actually talked to one another as we took care of a certain patient, by now it has fallen apart. And by virtue of market incursion, corporatization, bureaucratization, and the profit motive, it has been pretty much derailed as a form of giving care, at least for those who are not wealthy. We know of the wealth-health gap, that the wealthier you are, the healthier you are. There are treatments available to people who can pay for them. You know this. Who sets health policy in this country today? It's not the Department of Health and Human Services. It's the shareholders of Aetna and Prudential and United Healthcare. So we know all that. This is one of the many, many, many things that has taken a wrong turn, not unlike many of the other human services that you all are part of, or city government, right? I could take a detour about New York City, but I'm not going to. the interests of these conglomerate health institutions as fiscal units have trumped the needs of person seeking care, so that what now drives the delivery of healthcare is these algorithms of how many patients each nurse or PA or social worker or physician needs to see in a given period of time. Increasingly, these are all being taken account of. I mean, we have NPI numbers that I mean, it's as bad as the Russians in the election. And if you're not seeing your aliquot of patients in the given time, right now what happens is you don't get your bonus in your salary. But in another couple of iterations of these federal legislative things, your staff will start to be fired. If you don't maintain your productivity quota, your staff will start to be fired. So what I'm saying is that the profit imperative of the hospitals are overriding and overruling the necessities of delivering care. Doctors and nurses and social workers rail against the computer and the digital, and it's horrible. And one reason I wasn't sorry, one way I chose exactly the month to leave my practice was that I got out before they instituted ICD-10, which is the next level of diagnostic coding, because I knew it would be 6 months of torture. You get it? And my colleagues spend at least 60% of their time in front of computer screens. They cannot, because the hospitals, the corporate aspect of the hospital and the part that determines how much money they'll get from state, federal, local sources, force them to collect all kinds of information. You know, do you use your seatbelt? I'm supposed to ask my 95-year-old woman who lives in Washington Heights, does she use her seatbelt? Well, she doesn't have a seatbelt. You know, I'm also supposed to ask her about gonorrhea. But if you don't fill in every checkbox, you don't get to the next page. So you have to fill in every, even if it's ludicrous. And so people in practice will see their 20, 25, 30 patients during the day, and then they go home, maybe they have dinner, and then after dinner, they do their documentation, where they open their remote computers and they fill in all the charts that they've been speeding through. And so the son of one of my friends who's a pediatrician, he goes, "Oh, Dad, I see you're not coming to my Little League game tonight." Got it? So that's what's happening, and it's purely financially, economically driven. And everybody thinks it's awful. And the doctors, the nurses, the social workers, the clerical staff are quitting. And they're getting into other lines of work. They're turning to drugs. They're turning to alcohol. They're becoming depressed. You know this. There's around 500 deaths a year of physicians by their own hand. So we now have like suicide alerts. It's like emergent. More than one doctor a day kills himself or herself. The herself more than the himself. Do you see? It's called burnout. Like it's hardly, it hardly approaches the magnitude of the problem. We're just turning people away. Many of them complain most about the computer. I don't know why. It's not the computer itself, you know? I wish more complained about the disparities. There's something called moral injury. It comes from service members, soldiers, where on the battlefield they know what the right thing to do is, but they're not allowed to do it. When you know what's the right thing to do and you're not allowed to do it, it gives you moral injury. Jonathan Shea is the one who presented that concept. Well, it's true in medicine too. We know what's the right thing to do, but we're not able to do it, mostly because the patient is poor or not a citizen or not in the right zip code. So you carry with you this, I know what should have been done and I was powerless to do it. And this keeps adding to the shanda, the shame of the disparities on the basis of class, gender, race, primary language, and zip code, you know? So narrative medicine has social justice very much at its core. I mean, the reason we do all of this work is to improve healthcare for all. And more of our work is anti-racism work. Including marginalized populations on the basis of many of these strata. So it's urgent. It's urgent, and I can't tell you now if it's going to have a turn for the better.
I was going to ask you to talk about just that, building upon Lynn's comment, to talk about urgent care and emergency medicine, precisely those spaces where one often doesn't have a stable and ongoing relationship with the provider, and the power of narrative medicine in those moments, which is different.
So we're doing a project at Columbia. I'm just now writing the grant to get the money. And it's to bring narrative training to resident physicians, the interns and residents who are in the hospital day and night. And so I had to go from department to department to sign up programs to say that they would take part, were I to get the $1 million. And the ones who were most anxious to come in, like immediately, from the chair of the department was emergency medicine. Because they're the ones who were quitting in droves. And they, if you work in an emergency room, a busy one, so there's pressure from all sides. There's 50 people in the waiting room, and you're 48 behind. And there's doctors calling in saying, take care of my patient because she has to get to the ICU. And there's the nurses saying, you forgot to do this and you didn't do that. And finally you decide, oh yeah, this lady needs to go to the neurointensive care unit. And you call the neurologist. He says, no, I'm not going to take that lady until you do X, Y, and Z. And they're the ones. Those, they can be PAs, they can be nurse practitioners, they can be physicians. The ones in that seat, and they just get torn apart. There's no, talk about moral injury, there is no way to do the right thing. So we got them, and then we've got the medicine and some of the surgery people too. And they're the ones who are arguing. They're the ones arguing with the emergency room. No, 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 you can't send him to surgery. He needs to go to medicine. And medicine says, no, 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 we don't want that patient. It has to go to surgery. And they bicker back and forth. And there's the emergency medicine guy just in the middle. So there, can you fix that? What would it take to fix that? You know what it would take to fix that. A mission-driven, leadership-driven commitment to care for the neighbors. Sounds simple. Most of these academic medical centers are in urban settings. They're not in the suburbs with the fancy lawns. And so our neighbors are poor and sick. And the commitment needs to be that we care for them. So do you see, I mean, do you see how the whole medico-industrial complex kind of works against improvement in the disparities? We do, I mean, we have a public health school also at Columbia, so there are very active programs for harm reduction with opiate addicts and lead levels in tenement buildings and environmental toxins and fighting against, you know, various sanitation, plants that they put in poor neighborhoods. I mean, there is that, and that's active and we would hope somewhat effective, but it's at the individual, you know, when you're seeing the 78-year-old woman with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and she's been a smoker all her life, and she lives next to one of these sanitation plants. So what do you do for her, you know?
One final question before we end with our discussion of a poem. I was hoping we could come back to the classroom. If we could talk about, on a more positive note, some of the most effective ways that you found to teach listening in the classroom, and both the challenges and the opportunities as we try to also scale the intimacy of a classroom to the health system.
Yeah. Reading is very intimate. So I'm grading papers on my way up here on the train for my course in close reading. And this is in the graduate program. We give a Master of Science in Narrative Medicine. All classes are small. I had 11 students in this class. We spent half the semester reading very slowly to the lighthouse, like very slowly, 30 pages a week. And going systematically into the temporal elements and the spatial elements and the figural and the kind of narrative elements. And then the second half was in reading very closely Toni Morrison's Jazz, which in a marvelous way recapitulates some of what Wolf was doing, 50 years before. I had as guest faculty in my seminar Nicole Furlong, who is a literary scholar. She got her PhD in Princeton, specializes in African American and American literatures. And she has been writing about listening to fiction. The name of her book, I hope you know it, is Race Sounds. And she writes about Black literature as something that can't just be read, but must be audially experienced. Not only, I mean, a lot of people write about the blues as a framework for Black fiction. She's not just talking about that. In fact, she goes, I didn't even know, where's the jazz in Toni Morrison's novel? She wasn't exactly sure where the jazz was. But so she came and taught Baldwin and Toni Morrison, and she was like a beacon because she made us understand that listening is not just listening to music or listening to spoken word, but a opening of the receptive capacity of the one absorbing what is being emitted by the other. I'm trying so hard not to pigeonhole it into one sense or another. So we spend the semester listening to the fiction. There's a lot. So I'm reading these final papers, and there are several on Sonny's Blues by Baldwin, which is very much about a scene of music at the very end, but it's about the capacity of the narrator to become a listener to the other character, where the second character, by being a listening receptacle, a vessel, is able to allow the first one to actually listen. It's marvelous. So there was a lot, I mean, I made a point of making sure that there were Black writers and poets represented in the syllabus so that we were not just listening to the kind of Wolfe, James Joyce canon, but really hearing and taking into account the dictions, the rhythms, and the concerns of other communities. But it was so intimate. Now, granted, it was a small group, but because we're teaching narrative medicine, we make sure all the way along to be listening to one another. So every week there's some, you know, we use one of those discussion board things. So the students have to post answers, but then they have to answer one another's answer, so that the whole thing becomes very much a co-created fabric. And I'm sitting there on the train feeling so damn proud of these students. Look at what, woo! You know, I mean, it's, if you're a student, you don't know how your professors are like, whoa, look at what she did, whoa. I mean, and in this case, they were just exceptional. And it was because they had been guided and encouraged, mostly by Professor Furlong, to be listening radically to one another. We call it radical listening, which is listening without as much as you can the implied or even explicit biases and prejudices and assumptions and whatnot.
Thank you.
This place, like this place, is a sign of freedom.
So we thought it would be appropriate, we have about 10 minutes left together, and we thought it would be appropriate to conclude this conversation with a reading and a brief discussion of the work of Melvin Dixon, and specifically his poem, Heartbeats. And for those of you who are not familiar with Melvin Dixon's work, he authored two poetry collections, Change of Territory and Love's Instruments, and he was highly regarded for a textbook, Ride Out the Wilderness, Geography and Identity in African-American Literature.
About Dixon, the poet John Keane said, he emerged at a time when out Black LGBTQ writers and writing were still relatively rare, but beginning to come into our own. Dixon taught English literature at Wesleyan University and Queen's College, and died of complications of AIDS in 1992. So we were hoping that you could read it aloud and...
Oh, somebody else should read it. I shouldn't read it. I've been talking too much.
Taya, do you want it?
I haven't seen this before. Heartbeats. Workout. 10 laps. Chin ups. Look good. Steam room. Dress warm. Call home. Fresh air. Eat right. Rest well. Sweetheart. Safe sex. Sore throat. Long flu. Hard nodes. Beware. Test blood. Count cells. Reds thin. Whites low. Dress warm. Eat well. Short breath. Fatigue. Night sweats. Dry cough. Loose stools. Weight loss. Get mad. Fight back. Call home. Rest well. Don't cry. Take charge. No sex. Eat right. Call home. Talk slow. Chin up. No air. Arms wide. Nodes hard. Cough dry. Hold on. Mouth wide. Drink this. Breathe in. Breathe out. No air. Breathe in. Breathe in. No air. Blackout. White rooms, head hot, feet cold, no work, eat right, CAT scan, chin up, breathe in, breathe out, no air, no air, thin blood, sore lungs, mouth dry, mind gone, 6 months, 3 weeks, can't eat, no air. Today, Tonight, it waits for me. Sweetheart, don't stop. Breathe in, breathe out.
Yeah, so thank you so much for that powerful reading. When we had discussed this poem as a class, one of the things that we were talking about was the way that he was powerfully communicating his desire to live, his suffering throughout, but also the really rapid deterioration of his condition. And we saw this poem as a way of empowering him and humanizing him, especially in a moment where the AIDS community was so stigmatized in publicly. So we were just wondering whether you could share your own reflections and thoughts. And in particular, we were wondering whether you could emphasize the responsibility of the caregiver after hearing this poem or things like it.
Were you able to hear it? I mean, could you? You don't have it written in front of you? Pass this around, because I want you to see what it looks like on the page. It's in two columns, and each line has four syllables. Each line has four syllables, right? Work out 10 laps. That's one line. Chin ups, look good. That's the second line. It goes all the way through that. There's only three words that are more than one syllable. Fatigue, today, and tonight. Everything else is one-syllable words. It's like those fancy pantoons or something where there's very, very specific lexical rules, right? Or, you know, George Perec, who writes a whole novel without using the word, the letter E, those kinds of things, or even the sonnet form. I mean, those very restrictive, stylistic decisions. And it seems to me he must have said, I'm going to write a poem with words of one syllable. I mean, something along those lines. Just send that around. I just want you to see what it looks like on the page. But what did you hear? I mean, what stood out as you heard this? It was a beautiful reading. Thank you. What did you hear? Go ahead.
Maybe this is an obvious thing to other people, but I thought it seemed quite clever. Like, each line is like four syllables, but each line is kind of divided into two chunks of two syllables each, and
right.
If you listen to each of those chunks, I guess, diams, maybe? I don't know.
What would you call them? I don't know.
I don't know, but the little two-syllable chunks, right?
Yeah.
Kind of each sound like an actual heartbeat. Like,
yeah. Well, I think that was kind of an idea, because it's called heartbeats.
Yeah. I don't know. But it's kind of brings a very, like, visceral feeling to the piece, and
yeah.
You kind of are grounded to this person's emotions and as they experience these things.
Yeah. What do you hear? Any particular images? Go ahead.
What stood out to me was the repetition of breathing and the emphasis in the beginning on breathe, and then towards the end the reminder of breathe in, breathe out, that it's not solely the idea of inhaling and exhaling in the beginning of that's what breathing means, but the reminder that you need to take the breath in and out and consciously choose to do that.
Yeah.
Because your body is so weak that
it's
not like it's something you're doing naturally, that it takes the thought and the extra effort through the kind of deterioration of his body and mind.
Right. So it's something seen in a lot of illness narratives, that as people get sicker and sicker, they simply have to pay attention to making sure their body works, you know? And so some of them, I'm thinking of Charles Murphy and Christine Middlebrook, Oliver Sacks, who lose whole parts of their body. They lose, Oliver Sacks lost a leg as his was injured. And others who become paralyzed get like, they're completely alienated from part of their body that no longer kind of works or functions or something. And here, at the beginning, The first time you hear the word chin and up, it's in a gym. It's not chin up, it's chin ups. So at the beginning, he's working out, and he's got a sweetheart at the beginning. And it happens very, very quickly that the chin ups become chin up, which is like an act of bravado or something, chin up, right? What else have we got here? I mean, this is AIDS. How old was he when he died? He died in 92?
92, yeah.
And he was in his 30s, we don't know how old he was. But it sounds like he got very sick very fast.
Words and the cadence of it, it's all about the physical aspect of his health. Like, you can hear the heartbeat, and he's saying physical things that he's doing and that are happening to him, but what's not written is his story. So my mind
that's
told,
right.
Yeah, the story of his life and his sweetheart and what, you know, so it's all blended.
Yeah.
And that was powerful.
Right. When I first read it, I thought it was very thin. There was like it thins out. That in illness, the amazing texture, the you know, of ordinary life kind of flattens. And it's flattened to loose stool and trouble breathing and hard nodes. So that you know, if Lynn wants to know what should clinicians take away from this poem, it's in part that where's all the rest of it? You know? And even though it's not immediately said, I mean, people will come in to the office with lists. Here are the 12 things I have to remember to tell you. And it's the rash is back, and my vision is blurry, and when I eat too much quinoa, I get diarrhea, and all this stuff. And it's like these 12 things are all very, like, physical. And you have to say, well, you know, like, how are things? You know, how are things? When I meet new patients, I say, tell me what you think I should know about you. I'm your doctor. And they say, my elbow hurts and my skin rash. And I say, you can tell me about your life. So this is striking in its flatness. And I had to kind of get over my initial sense of, man, is this flat? To say, well, what's it flat of? That's bad grammar, but what are we not hearing? And you almost have to listen for the unheard, or you listen for the unsaid.